Welcome to the Possibility Project, an open conversation series where changemakers talk about the big questions we need to answer now. Your hosts are Devin Davey and Heather Hiscox, together with technical help from the nonprofit Snapcast. This series empowers the listener to shift systems, rebuild structures, and foster equity in the social impact sector.
Welcome to Possibility Project. We are a community of national disrupting change makers reclaiming our power through meaningful sparks, connections, and action. And we're so happy to have you here today with us. Today, we're going to start to talk about what if we designed the social sector from scratch. And this is a really special episode, not only because our featured guests are fantastic as per usual, but this is our 25th episode. And we've been running this conversation series and these episodes for almost 2 years now, which is super exciting. And you can check out all of our previous episodes on our website at possibilityproject.org. And you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel, and we'll send the link around, and you will also get all of this information that we're sending in the chat and talking about in an email after this episode. So we wanted to share that all of our episodes are also turned into podcasts by our friend Mickey Desai, who runs the nonprofit Snapcast. And Mickey is a friend and supporter of Possibility Project, and we're so appreciative for him creating a space to learn with this new podcast. And then also another one that's just come out called Inclusion Catalyst. So we'll share that link in the chat as well. And I want to do a little bit of introduction from these introduction guidelines that we've used from a previous speaker named Nova Ren. And this is a Zoom introduction guideline that you all are welcome to use. We'll send the link in the chat as well. It's from Genesis Healing Institute. And we encourage you to use it and are going to demonstrate what it is that we share through this document now. So my name is Devin Davey. I use she, her pronouns. I have brown eyes, brown hair, about just below my shoulders, and I'm wearing a purple top with earrings and an S. And I want to note too that we're going to share the transcript of today's episode in a follow-up email and to all registrants after the event. So I'm coming to you from land that was kept and held sacred by the Walkeen tribe, which are ancestors of the Ohlone Nation, and they call their homeland Halkjis. So I honor these ancestral keepers of their land and where I'm now living, and I honor their descendants who continue to breathe sacred life. And so just a quick note on territory and acknowledgements is that it's one small piece that's important but small of disrupting and dismantling colonial structures and well. So if you want to learn more about how this lightly touches the surface of power and privilege, we will share we'll share more information as to how you can find what land you're on, which most of you all actually probably know, I would guess already. So we want to note and recognize that we're also, as guests on this call, sharing a US-based perspective, and we really welcome perspectives from other places and countries. So now for just an intro, a little bit deeper for myself and my co-creator, Heather Hiscox. She is, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, doing some in-person facilitation, and so she'll be joining us a little bit later on this call. And so we have an, I want to make sure you're still with us. Sorry, I just got a note from Zoom. You're still with me. Yeah, okay, great. A note from Zoom that said you've been signed out of your account, which is shocking. So I was like, that's not true. Okay, still here. Thanks, Sasha. Great. So Heather is facilitating in person in the Bay Area, and so she'll be joining us later, which is great. And Chuck Brown is a friend and community member of Possibility Project, and he's going to be supporting some back end today. So thanks so much, Chuck, for being with us. Heather, just to do a little bit more of a deep dive about her work, Heather is the CEO and founder of Pause for Change, and she's changing the way that we change the world by sharing new skills with the social sector to address challenges and pursue opportunities in less time, using fewer resources while achieving greater impact. So we'll share her website there in the chat for you. If you haven't already looked at it, she's doing really cool projects with local government, nonprofits, foundations, and networks. And then, as you know, my name is Devin and I'm a strategy consultant. I mostly help female social entrepreneurs and networks by co-designing and implementing people and process solutions. And you can learn more about my work on my website at devin.com. And as most of you probably know or have heard a little bit about, we started Possibility Project when COVID hit the US. We were talking about all the dysfunctions in the sector, you know, for a while with a lot of our friends, and really wanted to make the moment matter. And we wanted to have conversations that were being had in the dark corners of Zoom and, you know, coffee shops where we would whisper so that our colleagues wouldn't hear us about all the dysfunctions and organizational challenges that we face at scale, talking about that at scale. And so this has been an entire volunteer project by all of our speakers, as well as Heather and myself. And so if you want to help us pay for how we run this conversation series, we'd love for you to make a gift and invest in our operations at opencollective.com/possibilityproject. We'll share that link a few times today. And we so, so appreciate your support. So Open Collective is actually an awesome platform if you haven't heard of it. They're called Open Collective Foundation, and they model transparency around income and expenditures just across the social sector, really working towards solidarity work in so many different aspects. So check them out. I want to talk to you next about what we're going to kind of work towards in this conversation today. So the why behind what it is we're talking about, but also our goals for why we're coming together. And so our goals for all of our conversations are fourfold. You can see them on the slide. And I just want to highlight the fourth one, which is examining our role in transformation, starting with ourselves. It's hard to do collective action and collective change and systems change work if we haven't done it at the individual level or the organization level. So that's why we really think starting with ourselves in these conversations is going to prompt action and change. So today we have in our agenda, our flow, three incredible leaders who are going to discuss the topic of redesigning, or what if we designed the social sector from scratch? And I want to share a bit about the why behind this topic, how we chose it. Then you'll meet our featured guests and another member of this amazing community in a small, tiny breakout room. If you can't use video in that breakout room, or you're not able to participate for any reason, stay with us and just message your person and say that you're not able to turn your join in a full way, which is totally fine. And then our guests are going to give a lightning talk, and they're going to answer the first question around dysfunctions. So what's dysfunctional about the sector in any level from their perspective? And then they're going to answer the second question, which is what's giving them hope and emerging in the sector, right? Same two questions we ask on every episode. And following that, we'll talk about any questions that you all as a participatory audience have. So feel free to populate the chat with as many questions as you can and are thinking about. And then we'll have breakout rooms so that we can dive deeper. And our three featured guests will be part of those breakout rooms. We'll share a bit of community care items about how to have a successful breakout room conversation. And lastly, after our peer conversations, we're going to come back together and hear takeaways from our featured guests, as well as reveal our final, our only episode in October, which is going to be the 19th, and that topic, which is also going to be really fun. So why did we pick this topic? After 24 episodes of Possibility Project, diving into assumptions, systems change, anti-racist, you know, questioning, and work from across the sector, we asked, like, what's the historical context of why these dysfunctions exist? Why we're dealing with a lot of these challenges currently? And we wonder what social impact or social change or social justice would look like without the legacy and history we've inherited. So who holds the reins, the purse strings, the power, and what would the social sector look like if it were actually created today, September 29th, 2021, if it were created today, what would it look like? What changes are needed in the fundamental pillars of the sector related to program design, philanthropy, community engagement, fundraising, leadership? And we hope to hear from each of you about what you would want to see changed and what you want to maybe keep and have remain the same. So with that, at Possibility Project, we like to introduce our featured guests in a bit of a different way. And each one, as I mentioned, is so phenomenal that we want to share a bit of their humanity and a little story with you about them. So to start, I'd like to introduce Faye Darmali, who's the founder and executive director of the San Francisco Urban Film Fest and founder of the Affordable Housing Community Development Finance Consulting based in the Bay Area. And so Faye, would you tell us a story about yourself?
Hi, thanks everybody. I feel so honored to be here and being called a featured guest. I feel like you all to be featured alongside with me. I want to hear about everybody's work. So fascinating. And my story is about belonging and why I do what I do. And I think it's centrally located within my childhood experience as a non-English, or I don't even know what the nomenclature is, somebody who didn't speak English when she got here. So I immigrated to the US when I was 8 years old from Jakarta, Indonesia. And I moved to the suburbs of Washington, DC and attended public school. And I don't know if you all remember this game, and I may be aging myself, which is when you put your head down on your desk and someone comes around and taps you on the shoulder, and you're supposed to guess who tapped you on the shoulder. I think it's called 7-Up or something like that. I don't think you guys know exactly what that is either. That's a soft drink that we used to have. Anyway, so I didn't actually know the rules of the game. So I was like, okay, I'm looking around. Everyone puts their head down on the desk. Okay, I can do that. And then somebody taps you on the shoulder. And of course I look up, but you're not supposed to, right? And everyone's like, no. No, and I was really, really confused and ashamed, and I could feel myself getting all red. So that sort of incident really stuck with me, and I thought, wow, you know, going forward, I'm going to have to be really, really aware about the diversity of the way people communicate and come to a space, right? There's so many different ways. And really that my life work is wrapped up in doing that. Specifically right now, I feel the great opportunity to do that by producing the SF Urban Film Fest. And we literally create those kinds of spaces constantly. And we're challenged to create openness and understanding and dialogue, and also to question why things are the way they are. Like, for example, like you can see behind me is a space, is a pop-up space that we use for a film screening. It's an empty retail store space in this area called Rincon Hill in San Francisco. This was an event that we had 4 years ago. The space is still empty. And we question, why do we build the spaces that we build? So that's my story about building inclusive and welcoming spaces to create a sense of belonging.
Awesome. Thank you, Faye. And I'm going to move to Jessica. So Jessica's the founder and CEO of Full Potential Ventures and has a fun story in and of itself, and also is located outside the US. I'll just share a fun fact. So Jessica, thanks for being with us. What's your story?
Hi, everybody. I echo Faye's feeling honored to be here. I have fangirled over the Possibility Project's work since the beginning. I have had the opportunity to participate in several episodes and have always been super impressed by them. So my story is one about humility. I, as an adult, had the opportunity to participate in a kayaking, outward bound kayaking trip in Alaska. And I had been sending high school students to Alaska I had been sending them to Outward Bound course years. And so I went into this experience with this really strange mix of being terrified and super cocky, thinking that I knew what the trips were like because I'd heard about them through students. And I was in shape and I was young and I had lots of energy. And I got off the plane in Anchorage. And if you've been to the Anchorage airport, you know it's not like JFK or Heathrow or, you know, it's small. And there was a woman collecting bags who was really geared up. She had on hiking boots and like gear. And I looked at her and I said, are we on the same course together? So we decided to have dinner together because our course started the next morning. And she said, I'm just going to go for a little run first before dinner. Would you like to join me? And I said, oh, no, I'm okay. When we went to dinner 3 hours later after her little run, she had gone for a 16-mile run. And she was really worried that the course was going to set her back on a marathon. So anyway, I started to get really terrified at that point. But then on the trek out, 100 miles out, we were dropped, all our gear. There was a woman who was on course with us and was really concerned that she wasn't going to be able to wear deodorant. So I thought, oh, well, there's the princess. She'll be the one that is falling behind. The first thing they did was dump us in the water. There were ice chunks floating by. We had to prove that we could get out of the kayaks and back in if we were flipped over in the middle of the sound. And then they proceeded to give a really long, stern explanation about staying away from icebergs. And if you didn't stay a half a mile from an iceberg, they could flip over. And if they flip over, then they take you with them. So we went into this kind of fjord area, and I quickly was falling behind, very behind my cohort, and couldn't paddle, couldn't go, nothing was happening, and very quickly found myself literally bumping up against an iceberg, scared shitless and screaming for help, but everybody was so far ahead they couldn't hear me. And finally the instructor turned around and she's like, what? And I'm like, help! I had a broken rudder, but it was also a moment of having deep humility and understanding what teamwork was and what it meant to be vulnerable and tell people that I was scared and that maybe I wasn't the most. I spent the rest of my time being a better team, vulnerable on those practices, my work as a and since Devin shared, I'm located in Portugal. So that's a different story, but.
Oh, thank you for sharing. Yes, you're in Portugal. You've formerly spent time in the Bay Area in Mexico. And one thing I didn't mention too about Jessica is that she's a mentor to mission-driven leaders and organizations and a talent strategist and just like everyone here, an all-around amazing human. And we're going to move to Marcus. And Marcus is a community-centered fundraiser, an anti-racist systems builder, an amateur chef, and director of institutional giving at New Leaders based in Dallas. And Marcus, what's your story?
Yeah, excuse me. Good afternoon and good morning, everybody. I am also likewise really excited to be here. My story is pretty recent. It's from last year. Like many of you, I'm sure I was affected. I was affected job-wise by the pandemic. I was laid off from my job. Really, you know, down on my luck feeling at that time. This was, you know, July of last year, so right in the middle of the pandemic. And so my partner and I decided to head off to the deserts of West Texas. Born and raised in Texas, it's a beautiful part of the state. If you haven't been, I highly encourage it. And on that trip, we spent a week out in the desert, and there was a few things that I learned. The first one was that the ground clearance of my CRV was not as high as I thought it was. And so that caused some issues. But the other one was really the kindness and generosity of humans and the beauty of that space that was the Big Bend area, Big Bend National Park and Big Bend State Park. And just being able to reconnect with both land and people in the time that was very dark, in the time that we were there from people, has been a really important touchstone for me as we to navigate the challenges of the pandemic, the challenges of being a Black man in America. And it's really helped me power the path that got me to, you know, the stage today.
It's so great to have a Texan and your perspective and voice and leadership with us, Marcus. Thanks for being with us. We're going to turn to some get to know you. So we're going to spend a few quick minutes for a mini conversation for introductions amongst everyone who's here today. So as we get the rooms ready, I will ask you to use your video, invite you to use your video if you're able to. And in the conversation, just introduce yourself briefly to your partner and answer the prompt, what's one thing that made you smile today? One thing that made you smile today. So let's see, Chuck or Heather, are we ready for our rooms? I think we're just
out there. Just to clarify, Devin, and because I'm no Heather here. Do you want maybe just two to three folks per
two
room?
Two folks for okay. Yeah, two minutes.
Thank you, Chuck.
just trying to help out.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see you all in a few minutes.
Okay.
Welcome back. I hope you had a great conversation with your partner. Just a little intro. Now, our featured guests are going to share a lightning talk for a few minutes, 3 or 4 minutes, and they're going to share their thoughts on the question that we always ask, which is, what dysfunctions do you want to disappear about the social? So y'all, please share your thoughts in the chat. And I think that I'm going to ask Faye for you to start us.
Okay, so I am actually new to the whole world or word, the words social sector. So I actually still don't know what that means, but it makes me uncomfortable because really I think what we're trying to address is social inequities. And so to say that we're in a sector is to miss the point, which is that we need to be cross-disciplinary, we need to be interdisciplinary. We need to be really reaching out beyond our silos and working together. I come from the field of urban planning, which is probably one of the worst siloed professions right now that could have the biggest impact in terms of addressing urban inequities, regional inequities. We work within the transit sector. We work within the housing sector. We work in the public education sector. We don't really work in the urban planning world. We work in our little silos, and it's very difficult for us to reach across. We all have our different languages. We use maps differently. We use graphs differently. And I think I'm jumping the gun a little bit because I'm always about solutions. So one way to bring cross-disciplinary back to the forefront is to use storytelling. And that's really one of the major reasons why I started the SF Urban Film Fest, is to elicit the help of the top storytellers in our society today, who are filmmakers, I believe. So I'm eliciting the help of filmmakers, if there's any filmmakers out there, to help us really reach across our silos and tell the story of communities comprehensively. Thank you.
Yes. Yes, Faye. I love this interdisciplinary, how do we reach across all different areas? And it's not just a like tight box sector, right? It's like, we're all needing to co-create and collaborate in so many different ways. That's a fantastic point. Marcus, I'd love to turn to you. What's dysfunctional about the sector from your perspective?
It was really hard to kind of narrow down the amount of things. I mean, as I noted in my introduction, my work can't be divorced from my physical presence, right? Like this, I am deeply affected by the environment that I live in and the history of this environment and how it's created me and how it's created my family and how it's created my neighbors. And so when I think about the work of the quote unquote social sector, to Faye's point, it is primarily about justice and collective liberation. The idea that we can all be free to control our own thoughts and actions, but also live within this collective society where we're all moving forward together in really getting to a place where we are all able to, you know, self-actualize and really be the people that we are destined to be. And so I think about this first in the sense of what exactly the sector tries to do from a day-to-day basis. The two stats that really stand out to me from this year are twofold. One is the fact that because of COVID-19, the World Bank estimates that there'll be as much as 150 million new people across the globe in extreme poverty, which is just a staggering number. It's obviously about half of the United States. you know, one tenth of India, however you want to, you know, cost like that amount of people. It's a lot of people. The other stat that I think about is the fact that in 2020, the United States got to the lowest percentage of people living in poverty in 60 years. And that's primarily because of government intervention. That's because the government said that this year we're actually going to redistribute some of these resources to make sure that people have what they need to get by. And it makes me think that, you know, I've been in the sector for most of my career. I know y'all have been in the sector for most of y'all's career. The question I really ask is what are we doing? If we can make so much of a difference just by a very simple policy decision, then what else can we do if we decide that people in land are first and foremost? And so that's really how I think about this. How can we move the needle in not going this incremental way and really think about these transformative ways to move forward our society? The second thing I'll touch on really quick is the way that we decide and the way that we assign accountability to organizations. So most of us, when we think about decision making in the social sector and nonprofits, you know, we think about the donors, we think about staff, we think about the board, all of whom may or may not be close to the communities of focus that they're and are really, you know, going towards solutions. It really should be flipped, obviously. Like, our communities of focus should be at the center of all of our work. You know, that's what we talk about in community-centric fundraising. That's what, you know, shout out to Creative Reaction Lab out in St. Louis when they talk about community equity-centered community design. These are the types of structures that we need to have in this sector. And because the sector is primarily designed, I believe, to maintain the status quo, we really don't get that. So I'm really looking forward to, you know, dismantling that in moving forward to a post-capitalist, post power society.
Yes, yes, you're getting a lot of snaps. You're getting a lot of head nods, Marcus. Some other things folks have shared in the chat is burn it all down an acceptable answer to what the dysfunction is. Someone else shared, makes me wonder how we're even defining sector and social, right? And our work is not divorced from justice and collective liberation. Someone else shared, what's the sector here to really do? And I feel like the sector is just interested in self-preserving. So some really great points. Jessica, let's hear from you.
Fantastic. Well, so on the other end of the spectrum from Faye, I had spent 20 years in the nonprofit sector and in it, and now on the periphery of it, development work. And so like Marcus, narrowing it down is a little bit hard to think about. So I'm gonna touch on three points and I'll start macro and go a little more micro. I think the first thing is that the sector, however we define that, but let's call it nonprofit and the funders and everything that are trying to do social good. The sector is really this tiny little Band-Aid. I think of those like little teeny tiny Band-Aids that I'm not even sure, maybe they're good for like infants, for really grave injuries. And I think both the Band-Aid being inadequate and the injuries are intentional. They're part of a white dominant, white supremacist, capitalistic system of oppression. And I think the sector's existence makes those people who hold up those systems of dominance feel better. And because those with power, money primarily, they say, here's this little Band-Aid. And so they get to feel better because they're doing something about the inequities that they don't own, that they are a huge part of. And they never give a Band-Aid big enough to actually heal. And at the same time, they keep injuring and the systems keep oppressing and creating the inequity. This cycle that is self-perpetuating, or as Marcus says, status quo. The second thing is who the sector looks to as role models. Who they're trying to model themselves after. And the thing that I think about here is as a leader in, as a positional leader in nonprofit organizations, I was often told by board members and donors that we should run the organization, and nonprofits generally needed to run the their organizations more like a business. And while I think there is some wisdom in how primarily corporate America, that's what they're talking about when they're talking about that, runs, particularly around abundance mindsets, innovation, failing forward, there's like there is some wisdom there that could be pulled forth. Mostly this is a passive aggressive insult. And what it's saying is you're not actually smart enough. You don't have the wisdom internally in your community and the people that are doing the work to actually do the work. And it's also saying you need to copy this capitalistic litigation fearing people are always replaceable model to get the work done. So there's a superiority in this statement that reinforces those systems of when's the last time, those of you that are working in nonprofit, when's the last time a donor or board member came to you and asked for advice on how to run their business better? In 20 years, it never once happened. So it's cocky. So, and then my third thing is that people aren't centered. Now, and I'm gonna contradict myself in this one, but people are not centered. And this varies, and mission-driven places, I think, do often center people more than for-profit places, but let's get real here. In general, in the nonprofit space, the work is what is centered, but it's in this martyrdom respect that where we pay staff poorly, often not living wages. They carry additional emotional labor in these intense environments. People burn out, they get sick, they go into debt. The amount of debt I carried to be able to work my first 5 years in a nonprofit sector took me years to pull out of. And the scarcity mindset says we cannot pay people. We cannot resource our organizations adequately and have enough staff so that people can work reasonable hours. We can't mess with our overhead because that'll screw up our charity navigator rating. We can't afford retirement plans. So we're constantly kind of keeping people down in an environment where we say we're trying to lift people up. So what is it? Are we really lifting people up when we're doing the work by keeping people down? I do recognize that a lot of nonprofits provide more flexibility in how people get to work. They allow for more space for emotion and vulnerability to show up appropriately in a work setting. And so there are some things that center people more, but for the most part, I think they're a long way off from centering. I think until you center people, you're just buying into all of the systems of oppression, part of keeping the status quo.
Oh, so juicy. So juicy, Jessica. I hope y'all are feeling some heat in your body and feeling a little fired up, because I am. And I just want to note one thing about fire is the ability that it can create, as from a fire state, California, which is currently burning in many different parts. Fire has the power for destruction as well as creation. So just want to acknowledge the heat that some of y'all might be feeling. Marcus Faye, is there anything you would add before we move to our next question? Yeah, I saw, Faye, please.
Oh, sorry, Marcus? No. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you so much for the fire. Thank you, everybody, for the fire. So I am actually new to the quote unquote social sector, the nonprofit world. My training is in urban planning, but also finance. So I worked in the private sector for a really long time. Doing like hardcore finance, which is low-income housing tax credit investments for people like Silicon Valley Bank. And what the main difference is that the private sector gets a very long runway to screw up, right? The private sector gets money to plan out 3-5 years in advance. So me being in the nonprofit sector for about a year and a half, we get $10,000 grants to do a website redo? What the hell? The website redo is connected to the strategic planning that I'm trying to do for 3 or 5 years. I need a new website every year as we change for 3 or 5 years at a time. And I need money for the person to do it. And I need money for me to do it. And I need money for risk capital if we fail. What's the difference? What's the difference between how Silicon Valley Bank functions versus the way that we function at SF Urban Film Fest? The only difference is that SDB is a bank and we're a nonprofit, not even, we're fiscally sponsored. And the level of distrust to me as somebody who runs the SF Urban Film Fest versus me, who's the banker, and I'm actually the same person, is crazy. It's crazy. Like, hello, you're going to give me, you're going to give me, exactly, you're going to give me $25 million last year when I was the banker, but you're only going to give me $10,000 because I'm a nonprofit leader now. I'm the same person.
And why does Silicon Valley get a long runway for their own work and then they turn around and say to the nonprofit that they're donating to, can you give us a 15-page report on that, why you need that website for us to decide, and then tell us how you use your website and show, prove all of the impact in the community of that website. And you have to do it fast.
The only difference is that apparently Silicon Valley Bank makes money.
These are such great points. I can't help but laugh because it makes me so terribly uncomfortable. And it's so ironic because we all have lived one part or another of what y'all are talking about. We have lived the effects of what you're talking about. So I think just bringing it back to the collective, the systems and the infrastructure, the organizational dysfunctions, as well as the individual leadership dysfunctions at every level, we've all experienced. Y'all had some great things to share in the chat as well. So I hope y'all are looking at what your peers are sharing. And I see a lot of like exhaling too, right? If we're living in our bodies. And so just kind of like letting go of what it is that we just talked about a little bit, because I do want to move us to our second question, which is what's emerging in the social sector or in this connected, interdependent ecosystem that we all live in? And what's giving you hope about what's actually working and the future of how we could work differently and better and more integrated, right? So Marcus, I'll turn to you for that question. And if you want to address any dysfunctions, you know, feel free, this is your space, anything you want to talk about.
I have some doozies, so y'all stay with me. I'm gonna start with the easier one. What really gives me hope is the work of movement work, really and truly. The people who are truly on the ground. Like I started my nonprofit career, as you will, in the NAACP and in high school and college. Got away from being on the ground, and it's just now getting back to that work with community-centric fundraising. And I'm starting to you know, realize how important that, like, being connected to the ground really is. And so I think in particular, in addition to, again, community-centric fundraising, which we'll give you the website if you haven't heard of us, please hang out. I really want to point out movements like movements to transform us to a post-capitalist society. So the solidarity economy is one term you may have heard of. The Nonprofit Quarterly, this most recent issue talked all about the solidarity economy and how we are already starting to make those shifts to an economy that is less about capital and more about people. And so you see that through co-ownership, through co-ops, you see that through, you know, credit unions, which have existed for decades. These types of things that are shifting power and responsibility and decision making to people and societies. These are the things that give me hope. In that MPQ magazine, there's a really great article by Emily Kwano about imaginal cells. So the cells that butterflies use to turn into butterflies from caterpillars, and how that connects to how we can make this transformation. It's essentially breaking it all down, burning it all down, and recreating something that's much more beautiful and better. That's what's giving me hope right now. I want to see the floor, and then I'm going to throw out something really wild later on.
Awesome. I just shared that article that you referenced from NPQ, and we're going to share all the resources that our featured guests and this community comes together with and shares at the end, probably before the end of this week. And let me ask Jessica, what's giving you hope?
A few things, but hands down, the biggest is young people. And I'm the mom of a 13-year-old, so I get to hang out with 13-year-olds. But I also feel very strongly about having intergenerational mentors. And so I knew my daughter was considered a Gen Z, but that a Gen Z that's 13 is really different than a Gen Z who is in their early 20s. And so I have Gen Z mentors in their early 20s and just try to spend time soaking up and basking in their fire often. And so I think along with that, it is emerging some of what Mark was talking about, the people of color-led movements in particular, open organizations, both the movements and the organizations that are people of color-led that are reminding us of different ways of being in community, of communicating, and of getting work done. So we're seeing some pushback on the hierarchical structures, on the one leader design, like just different ways of thinking about how can things. Another thing that's giving me hope is equity work is becoming a business. And it has taken a lot of years, but I think, unfortunately, a lot of this has happened on the heels of George Floyd's murder. But what I spend some of my time as a co-consultant at a diversity, equity, inclusion firm, and what we're seeing is some businesses really intentionally embracing equity work and doing work to shift even their mindsets around capitalistic revenue structures. And we're talking about advertising agencies and Hollywood focused consultants and people that are really doing this work. And you know, on the other side of that, we're also seeing people who are doing service. And I'll just mention one movement that I just find really powerful, which is the REST, is the napping movement. So the REST is resistance. REST as a form of resistance movement. And I think it's really powerful to claim that we're not going to be cogs in. And so I think a growing amount.
So juicy. So great. Thanks, Jess. Faye, what's emerging and giving you hope?
Thanks. And Marcus, so unfair that you're like dangling this thing. I really want to know what it is.
I got to keep suspense.
Speaking of storytellers and storytelling, that definitely is giving me hope. So when I was raising my twins when they were little, I picked up screenwriting and to do on the downtime when they were sort of napping, and really fell in love with screenwriting. And that's partially how the film festival came to be. And what I found is that storytelling is a great tool to connect complex policy and lived experience. And so we developed at the SF Urban Film Fest storytelling workshops that we conduct in 3 hours. We can teach nonprofits and public agencies and startups how to center their narrative about why they exist and infiltrate the public imagination. We're also doing a short documentary with Soma Filipinas in San Francisco about the story of redevelopment and urban renewal and how the Filipino community has come around for decades to resist displacement. So storytelling and storytellers, working with artists, we're part of a YBCA-led, YBCA's Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, which is a social impact museum, I guess is what I'm going to call it. They're starting a artist-led giving circle. So basically it's like an impact fund, but run by artists. And I guess I can put an artist hat on too, which is because we're part of that. And we're trying to create what Marcus was talking about, the solidarity economy, really focusing on how artists can make something out of nothing, and that we always are centering our quote unquote production with our communities in mind, and definitely equity in mind, what Jessica was talking about. And then one last thing, I'm going to put my banker hat on, which is that we really believe in self-determination versus philanthropy. And so to the extent that an economic system that's centered on the community is self-determined, that means that we create fees and services and products that we decide are important for us, versus like the philanthropy sector telling us what they think is important that we do. So we're really looking at different ways of doing hybrid business models. Thank you.
Awesome. Such wonderful points. I want to make sure that Jessica and Marcus, there's nothing else you would add before we go to questions from our participants. So feel free, anything.
One other thing that I've been seeing is more and more funders, and maybe this is particularly on the coasts, I don't know, but more and more funders who are starting to give in really different ways, and that they're trying to break the paradigm as well. And so I think there's a level of self-reflection and awareness happening in philanthropy. I don't know how deep that goes, but we certainly have some models of seeing that.
Thanks for that. Maybe, yeah, Marcus. And when do we get to hear this reveal?
Oh no, this is it. So I think that when we think about like what it actually means to remake this sector from scratch, as I said earlier, these are all policy decisions. These are all societal decisions. So what I would propose to, you know, to all of y'all, really, is this really reimagining of how our society reallocates resources. In that scenario, in my ideal scenario, we have this vastly expanded safety net that looks closer to what it looked like last year in the midst of the pandemic. This massive safety net where we actually do have all the things that a lot of people support, like, you know, single payer healthcare and, you know, food security for all, and all of these things that I think that we as a country, like as the United States, should be able to do. The flip side is I think that means a radically reduced social sector. Like, I think that actually means organizations close. I think that means people lose jobs. I think that's a real, you know, side effect of that. But if we get closer to what Faye is talking about, where the social sector is a part of society, in fact, it's on the vanguard of society. It is arts and culture, and it's still fighting for justice. It's doing all of these things that help us move along and get better as people, but it's not this thing that's just kind of turning around the same ideas and funding over and over. It is actually different, and is actually beneficial to us as a whole. I think that's what I would put out to the group to discuss.
Great topics for our breakout room. Thank you, Marcus. You're brilliant. I have a couple of questions, and I know Heather does too. And so we want to shift for maybe the next, you know, 8 or 10 minutes into some questions. Heather, you have a really hearty one. And so I think I'm going to start with one that's a little bit easier to tackle. And then we want to answer and address and discuss the questions that you all have. So please share in the chat anything that you want to bring up. So I think there's a question that I've been noodling to, and anyone who feels called to speak to this, Joyce Lee Ibarra is one of our previous featured guests on an episode called Radical Allyship, and she's here in the room with us today. And Joyce brought up something about also agreeing with Jessica around the DEI and equity kind of practices being adopted more so. And I think there's still this tension, this dynamic tension and a polarity on a spectrum around performative work and genuine, authentic work. And so I'm curious if y'all, maybe, you know, we'll talk to examples that you've seen that are actually genuine, or, you know, just kind of calling in a little bit more specificity.
I'm happy to jump in there since I lobbed that out there. This is a recent example that just gave me so much hope, based on a project that I had been part of working on. An organization that is deeply embedded in billable hours as the way that they are paying their staff, and that became a real through line of of challenge generally for their equity systems, how people could move up in the organization, how people could find the space and time to pause to do equity work. And it is how they work. It's like telling a lawyer that you're not going to have billable hours. But as we were diving in with them, it became clear what an obstacle that was. And we have been shocked to find that the founders of that company are now trying to untangle their system of billable hours in an industry where this is the only, and they're having a staff-led process for designing a new for them. And so I don't know what the final outcome will be, but given that their initial response was to prickle when we said this is a fundamental problem, they moved in. And so, and I have a handful of other examples where people are moving in, and are obviously on different parts of the domain, but that is an example of somebody saying, okay, we're not going to play by this rules.
Marcus, Faye, any other thoughts before we turn to Heather?
Yeah, so I have another personal example. I think this is again one where the outcome is unknown because the pandemic hit. But in that organization that I mentioned that I was laid off from, we were undergoing this process to actually redesign our board of directors. So we had, at that point, we had a founding board. That founding board had decided to, you know, resign and move on to other projects. In its place, we had installed a design board, essentially, three folks who would go in and lead the facilitation of completely redesigning the board governance structure. And this is a, you know, a $15 million organization. This was going to be a big deal in an area in North Texas and Dallas where it would have caused some issues down the road that really meant that we would have been challenged, essentially. We would have been challenged in funding. We would have been challenged in terms of visibility in our contracts that we were getting as a fee-for-service organization. But we were really determined to do this. And so as we were starting to design this thing, the pandemic is actually closed. But when you talk about like what it actually takes to be, not just be performative and actually do the work, sometimes it's that drastic. Sometimes it is completely overhauling your board and reinfrastructure. And that's really what it takes a lot of time to Jessica's point.
Yeah. And that makes me think too of this question around reimagining how we operate. What are the structures, the policies, and the practices that we can reimagine? Because we have the power to do that in so many spaces, especially if it's a collective power. Heather, you have a great question here. How do you overcome expectations to shift the work? And repeating good what Marcus shared. And tell us more. What's on your mind about this big question you have?
My question is I'm going to put it in the chat, Audre Lorde's quote that, you know, so many of us know, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. And Devin and I talk about this all the time, and it comes up on lots of different episodes. Like, can the change really come from within? Does it have to come from like outside the gate, like outside the walls? And so I'm so curious about, and I believe totally in both and, right? But I'm really curious to hear your thoughts about this inside transformation and the external transformation and pressure to do so.
Now you can take the first shot. It's a big question.
I think that's part of why I am feeling so hopeful about the rising amount of people of color-led movements and organizations and also trans led and, you know, just different leaders coming to the forefront, because I think they are bringing different tools. And I think the nonprofit sector has been white for a very long time. And in that, there's been deeply embedded white saviorism. There's been all of the ways that we bring the white dominant culture that we have inherited into the way we do work. And so I do think it takes external external people. And I think, to your point, Heather, of it being both and, I think external people can push internal people to see differently. And I think the example I was using of the advertising agency and their billable hours, it took external people really pushing in and holding up kind of the dysfunction and then their willingness to internally grapple with it. But they need to continue to engage external perspective to make sure they're not falling back on those. So I think there can be a marriage between the two, but I think it is not possible without external.
Yeah, I 100% agree, Jessica. I think I would add that it really has to be both. It really does have to be both when you're talking about like organizational change. There's only two ways to change, really. It's either internal pressure or external pressure, right? Like one of those has to be great enough to force change within your organization. I want to zoom out and think about, again, the policies and the system that we kind of currently live in. And I think that there are a couple of things that are, I think that if you believe in the US system of representative democracy, I think that unless you're willing to overthrow the system, which, you know, is a completely different conversation, I think unless you're willing to overthrow that system, I think that we can create change through policy within that system. And that involves all the things that, you know, getting people to vote, that involves removing the influence of money in politics, all of those big things that really allow people to control decision making. And then I think there's this other point to some of the other questions that have been in the chat. Commerce and capitalism aren't the same things. And so once we get past the point where we still have a system where we buy and sell things, but we're not attached to the system that exploits people and land, then we can say, oh yeah, we can keep this part of the system, but then we can change this part of the system. That's where you get to that, again, that post-capitalism, that solidarity economy. That's where we need to go. And it has to be through It has to be both through the existing levers, and it also has to be through like people really demanding change. You know, most change has only come through like revolutions and lawsuits, right? So unless we can do that, you know, or we can get more people to vote and pass the max to remove outside influences from politics. There are many ways to do it, and it takes a lot of work. I'm saying this with the realization that this is decades upon decades of work that people have done already, but it is totally possible, and I want to continue believing that.
So juicy. Faye, anything else to add?
Yeah, very juicy. Thank you so much. Revolution or lawsuits. I'm going to put that on a t-shirt. So to keep focus, on equity, yes, definitely inside, outside, public sector, private sector, nonprofit sector, everyone on at the table. But as Angela Blackwell of Policy Link says, we need to focus on our most marginalized. In this case, it would be, low-income women of color. So if we create an equitable world for low-income women of color, then we've got everybody covered. What would that look like? You know, if we keep our eye on the prize of helping low-income women of color, we would have universal childcare, we would have free, amazing public schools, we would have free transit, we would have parks that are safe, we would have lights on at night everywhere, and everybody would benefit from that. Everybody would want that. So yes, everyone at the table, and really focus on who we really need to serve.
Ooh, such a powerful message. And we could keep talking about this for days and only move this far, but we do want to go deeper in our conversations with each other. And so Heather's going to move us into breakout rooms. You have 10 minutes in each breakout room. I'm going to share a few community care items as we transition into a different space and just absorb all of the brilliance of these three leaders, of which y'all shared. So we want this breakout room to be a safe space for everyone to share. So if you choose to, the breakout rooms aren't going to be recorded, but there's also an expectation that what's shared will be kept confidential. So after we debrief from the breakout, we can share takeaways in our chat, but don't share attribution. We also invite you to take space, the kind of plus or minus two rule. I don't know if you've heard about this, but speaking after folks and not just jumping right away. And being a gracious partner and thanking your person and people at the end of a conversation. We have a facilitator who one of you will be the facilitator of each of these conversations. And the person who spent more than 30 minutes outside most recently is going to be the facilitator of the conversation. And it's really just holding space, making sure that everyone can share, that you're remembering the prompt and moving a nice flow along. And if you get lost in the interwebs, you will, you can return to the main session. Heather will help you out and move you. Be mindful of time. You've got 10 minutes. Make sure that everyone is sharing as kind of equitably as possible. And we will share some broadcast love notes with you about timing and the prompt. The prompt is, what's sticking with you so far from the conversation? And we will give you a 60-second warning for coming back. And then we're gonna do final takeaways, share and hear from our fantastic featured guests, as well as reveal the next episode. So Heather, take us away. We'll see you in 10 minutes.
Thank you for joining us. Please do join us for the next live Possibility Project so you can take part in the breakout sessions that follow. All sessions are recorded. Please visit possibilityproject.org and connect with us on LinkedIn so we can invite you to meet more incredible impact influencers and make new connections with people who care about what you care about. This has been Possibility Project, produced in cooperation with the nonprofit Snapcast.